Ryan, Team Dinkytown Real Estate Group brings you Gopher Gridiron Radio. If you remember, they have already sold their first home. It was on the market for 3 days. They got 7 offers. The list price was $389,000. They sold the house for $441,500. That means 1% of that sale price went to Dinkytown Athletes. $4,441.50 went to all Gopher sports when it comes to NIL. Ryan, if you have a home to sell or even that you are looking for a home to buy, you should be working with Team Dinkytown Real Estate Group.
I mean, it seems pretty simple to me. If you're looking to get the most bang for your buck, plus you want to support Gopher NIL efforts, you go to teamdinkytown.com, you fill out their questionnaire, or you can call them at 612-250-8562. They've already proven that they can get multiple offers, sell your house for over asking, and 1% of that goes to Dinkytown Athletes, the sport of your choice, or in this case, as that seller decided, all sports. So again, teamdinkytown.com, or give them a call today at 612-250-8562.
And welcome to another episode of Gopher Gridiron Radio. I'm Luke Buer.
And I am GopherIllustrated.com publisher Ryan Burns. And we welcome you guys to the first ever edition on the history of Gopher Gridiron Radio of the Floyd of Rosedale finally effing came back to Dinkytown as your Golden Gopher football team. As I wrote after the game on Gopher Illustrated, if you're going to put anything on that game, you're going to put lipstick on a pig. But if you're going to as well, you know, take the pig, might as well take it back home with you. I screwed that up. I've got about 2 hours of sleep on me.
You're
today.
All good, man.
But it's a 12-10 victory. I witnessed it in Iowa City, as I'm sure many of you guys did as well. A lot to talk about. It wasn't the most aesthetically pleasing game in the world. I'm not here to convince you of that otherwise today. But joining us is Dinkytown Athletes co-founder, my second cousin, former Golden Gopher offensive lineman, Derek Burns. Derek, they finally did it. They got over the hump in Iowa City for the first time since 1999. The Axe and the Pig are in Dinkytown consecutively for the first time since 1993. And they beat a very smug Kirk Ferentz, who I know you've got some thoughts on that we'll get into. But how are you today, Derek, knowing that the Pig is back in the Twin Cities?
I'm doing really well. I'm glad. Thanks for having me back, guys. I'm glad they were able to win it, not only get the Pig back, but win it at Iowa, which is not easy. And, you know, this is, if you're a college football fan, games like this, the rivalries are kind of what separates it from other sports. You could see even all week, I'm sure you both had lots of conversations with fans and family. This one was important for Minnesota. There was no doubt. So it was good to see him come away with a win.
All right. So maybe most importantly, what we need to do is cover the controversial call or replay.
I want people to know before we even do, Luke Buer has a lot, you know, he is the special teams guru of this podcast. He has a lot of thoughts and feelings about this, and then we'll kick it to Derek, who has thoughts and feelings about how this is being portrayed, specifically by a head coach. But Luke, get into your favorite invalid signals discussion and why people need to be listening to that specifically.
All right, so first, I want to start by, I've listened too much, and I do enjoy your podcast, Ryan, but Chip Scoggins and Dan Barrero, frankly, did a not a great job discussing this situation. So, number one, Mark Crawford kicks a 37-yard punt. I think most importantly, he puts it towards the sideline. Not a great punt. It was only 37 yards, but it was positioned well. Now, the Gopher defense or the Gopher coverage team does a terrible job. Ultimately, Cooper DeJean returns that for a touchdown. Now the play is under review. I'm going to pose just some quick hitting questions for you guys. Are all scoring plays under review in college football?
I believe the answer yes. you're looking for is yes.
Okay. Number two, now the play is reviewed. The assumption is that Cooper DeJean is, they're checking to see if he stepped out of bounds, right? Well, the reality is he didn't, and that was fairly obvious very quickly. So now the time is, it's taking a lot of time. And I immediately messaged you guys upon watching, and now I realize that I often am on delay because of I stream games, etc. But I asked you, they might be looking at this for an invalid fair catch signal. Now, more importantly, the language that they use when they come out and overturn the play, is the language that is used is an invalid signal. So what we have to be talking about when we're looking at the rule is, what is an invalid signal? Well, there's actually a whole section on this in the rule book. Now, this gets down to the letter of the law and the spirit of the law, and we can get into this. But in an invalid signal is, they cover both catch and recovery. And the ruling is in section 6-5-3. There are five different articles or parts that can make up this. And most importantly, the definition of an invalid signal is team A, scrimmage kick is rolling beyond the neutral zone when team 17 alerts his teammates to stay away from the ball or get away signal, ruling invalid signal. The ball is dead when the team has recovered. So now we can get into the semantics of this, but if you look at that objectively, Cooper DeJean is waving his arm. He is also pointing his arm. Now, that to me is he's waving his arm to say either dead or something. It's not, he's not trying to make a fair catch signal, but that is an invalid signal upon which when you touch the ball is dead. Now, this is the way I read the rule, trying to look at it objectively. Yes, I'm a Gopher fan. I totally recognize that. But I also try to look with some objectivity. And the reality is when I read that rule as is, that is an invalid signal. That's how they called it, and it was properly called. Now, what frustrates me is what Kirk Ferentz has done is tried to say that they had an early conversation about what a fair catch is, what isn't a fair catch. Kirk, I'm sorry, man. That the call wasn't whether or not it was a fair catch. It's an illegal signal. Now, this can get into the spirit of the law, right? So the spirit of the law is what makes officiating frustrating in general. And frankly speaking, it's not always enforced explicitly and consistently. That can be true. But there is precedent for this, Ryan, which you and I talked about. In 2015, Wisconsin had a very similar situation of which they had an invalid signal returned for a touchdown called back against Northwestern. It's not like this is unique or new. We've had rules officials comment on this numerous times, including Mike Pereira back in 2015, that this is one, a reviewable play, and two, enforced correctly. I do believe this was enforced correctly. I understand the emotion gets in on this, but I think it's important that we talk about this in the using the correct language. This is an invalid signal applied correctly to the letter of the law. Now, Derek, I know you probably want to talk a little bit about Kirk Ferentz here. I frankly think that he's obviously talking about it incorrectly relative to what was said. Ryan, can you explain maybe before that, a pool reporter got to talk to the official, and when you read the quotes from the official, like, it's even more clear that they're saying this has nothing to do with the fair catch, but an invalid signal.
I think that's the longest consecutively I've ever heard you talk on the many years of this podcast.
Well, I wanted to make sure we oriented the discussion correctly, and there's a lot to get into. Do I need to define spirit of the law and letter of the law? I don't think I need to. I think
you're all right.
All right, good.
But here's what. So yes, there was a pool reporter, I believe it was Scott Docterman of The Athletic, who talked to him after the game, the Big Ten referee, and here's the direct quote. Let's start with the definitions that surround this play. This is what the referee says. With regard to, there are valid and invalid signals that can be given during any kick play. An invalid signal is any waving motion by a receiving team member that happens throughout the kick. This is the first piece of information you have to apply here. Now, going back to the play, the receiver makes a pointing gesture with the right hand and makes multiple, I'll say it again for Iowa fans, multiple waving gestures with his left hand. If you look at the video, you see that. The waving motion of the left hand constitutes an invalid fair catch signal. So when the receiving team recovers the ball by a rule, it becomes dead. That is the reviewable element of the game. We let the play run out, but when we went to review, the review shows with indisputable evidence that there is waving motion with the left hand, and that's when the rules apply. I think he did a really good job of summarizing it with the pool reporter because, to your point, Luke, and to the detriment of my parent of spare host, I think that the confusion lies with the fair catch versus not fair catch. That's not what it's about. But, Derek, I know that you want to discuss kind of what Kirk Ferentz was doing and deflecting after the game.
Yeah, I just – before I comment on that, I wanted to just clarify – it's important to understand why this is a rule. On punt coverage, you have gunners, bullets, whatever you call them, the outside contain people, and sometimes guys in the middle running full speed, 30 to 60 yards downfield to cover a punt. It's critical that those defenders understand clearly whether or not the receiver is signaling a fair catch or not. That's why there's the rule. Because in one case, if the coverage unit doesn't understand it's a fair catch, they could seriously harm or injure the player catching the ball. And similarly, if they think it's a fair catch, like in this case, if they thought that was a fair catch signal and they pull off, that's providing an unfair advantage to the receiving team. So I saw, in fact, one person speculating that, well, I understand it's a penalty, but why don't they just let the play out and enforce the penalty on the ensuing play? Well, you can't do that because the defenders may be pulling off thinking it's a fair catch, and so they're not executing their coverage. So I just think it's important to point out why this is a rule. It's because it has to be clear to the coverage unit whether or not the person receiving the ball is signaling a fair catch or not. That's the whole reason for the rule. Now, yes, my comments on the way their head coach handled it was disappointing. I have had a lot of respect for Kirk Ferentz through the years. I think he's a good coach. I think his teams are incredibly fundamentally sound. I know they don't play the most exciting brand of football, but what he's able to get out of the talent they have is he does it as well as anybody, and he's done it for over a decade. I lost a lot of respect for the way that he handled this, and, you know, purporting he and the team to be victims. And, you know, maybe, Luke, to your point, just flat out not understanding the rule. Maybe there's some ignorance there, but it was very disappointing to see that, because you're inciting a fan base and, you know, again, you're putting yourself in a victim position when, in fact, that's not the case. So hopefully hopefully somebody gets to him after the game or this week and clearly explains what the call was, and then it was in fact correct, and maybe he issues an apology or makes a statement this week explaining that, yeah, the call was actually correct and we shouldn't pretend like we got, you know, screwed over.
Yeah,
I mean, if you're
go ahead.
Maybe, you know, hypothetically here, maybe he's trying to deflect blame off of his son, who continues to run an offense that is just yikes.
Here's the thing that I'll say. When it comes to Ferentz and how he handled this situation, I don't think he necessarily needs to apologize. But generally speaking, you know, it's okay. It's okay to plead ignorance and go, you know, I didn't understand or whatever. But to be so vehement that, you know, they told me something before the game that didn't apply to the rule that they called, that's the thing that I just had trouble with in general. I don't think he needs to apologize, but he can acknowledge the fact that, you know, I might have been wrong in this situation, but he doesn't have to apologize. Emotions are obviously, they take time. for anyone, right? And in that kind of big emotional swing, that's hard. And I empathize with that to an extent. And I don't blame them. But in the same respect, objectivity has to win out. And in this situation, I do believe that it was applied correctly. I recognize some people are going to disagree. And that's where subjectivity comes into place. And it's up to the officials, right or wrong, to make that determination. In the end, we've talked a lot because, you know, we've had consternations against officials, but the reality is you got to make the plays to win. And I recognize you're going to say, well, Cooper DeJean did make the play to win. Yeah, but there's also rules for a reason. And, you know, you have to try to call those to the best of your ability. And I do think that the officials did that to the best of their ability. And I think the last thing I want to mention here is, I don't know about you guys, I know, Derek, you got to watch the game on TV, right?
Yep.
The rules analyst, dude, he was terrible. Like,
yeah. on multiple plays.
Yeah. In both ways, right? Like, I mean, we could get into the targeting if we want, but like, I thought just in general, like, he was bad. And this is where it's important that the people that have a platform and a voice are well reasoned, right, and can speak to things intelligently. For instance, the one color commentator at one point says, he goes, you know, some people are going to call that a pick or a rub on a Darius Taylor catch. And, you know, the guys were out basically blocking. He caught the ball behind the line of scrimmage, man. Like, get it right. You can block downfield all you want if you catch the ball behind the line of scrimmage. It doesn't matter. Like, just the ignorance of the folks on the television broadcast. In short, I just have to say, I have not been impressed with NBC to date so far in either of the games that Minnesota has done. And it's both ways. It's not just Minnesota, right? It was just they were just frustrating in general. And the fact that they can kind of get people down the wrong line of thinking, that's the thing that's frustrating as well.
Yeah. I don't know that I got anything more to, I mean, I was obviously at the game and when I watch it back, I don't watch it with the
audio
with the sound on.
Yeah, but it's all good.
I mean, either way, I mean, we'll get to it a little bit later, but how about you not have six guys end up to the left of Cooper DeJean there?
Yeah, we probably should.
We'll get into that later.
Why don't we actually just finish this little segment out and talk special teams? Because
what is there left to say?
Here's what there's left to say. The reality is Dragan Kesic is good. We can't take anything away from him, right? Given the conditions there that were reported, Ryan, you got to kind of experience them. It's not easy to kick with wind like that, right? 4 for 5 on the day. Good on him. But like the kick returns hitting the ground is perplexing. That can't be a strategy, right? And then additionally, you know, the play with Cooper DeJean towards the end too, like, what are we doing here, fellas? Like, there have been a number of special team gaffes. It's been over a number of years. I mean, I messaged you guys at one point, like, if this return was, you know, assuming it had stood, right? If this return doesn't get Rob Wanger fired, I don't know. I don't think anything will. It frankly, there has to be accountability somewhere. And unfortunately, in these situations, it comes down to the coach. But the special teams, again, continues to just be just such a head scratcher. I think the question we have to start asking ourselves is why, Ryan, other than you, is nobody in our local media talking about this, right? You get a lot of crap about this. But like, honestly, where is Andy Greeter? Where is, Randy Johnson? Where is Dan Barrero? Like, where are these people? Why are they not holding the special teams coach or PJ more accountable to this? I don't know, Derek, you can weigh in there, but I frankly don't know.
Yeah, I think you're on the right track and that maybe, because I mean, maybe that'd be different if the penalty hadn't been correctly called on the last play. Maybe there would be more of a groundswell. I just will go back to game one. We talked about this, and my suggestion was, and this isn't hyperbole; it's an honest suggestion. Is the return units, kick return and punt return, throw them out the window and come up with something new. Start over. It doesn't. That's okay. That's a strategy. You can tweak things here and there, or you can just completely start over. The opening, we're not going to go play by play, but the opening kickoff, which, you know, caught the wind and ended up almost hitting one of the returners and bouncing and then being picked up. Here's another problem I have with that play. So the ball bounces, which should never happen on a kickoff. That's when it goes deep, but it almost hits Quentin Redding, and he turns around and three guys come through unblocked and blow him up. Who are we blocking anybody? I mean, beyond the fact that the ball bounced in front of the returner, you have three defenders coming through unscathed. I don't understand. So yes, there are issues actually receiving the punts, and in this case, the kicks, but I don't know that we're doing anything blocking wise either. And I think evidence to that would be the number of times that we actually decide to return a kickoff and not fair catch it. Almost without exception, it's a loss of yards. So it's tackled inside the 25, which just proves that we're not blocking anybody. So I don't have much more to add beyond that. You're right, Luke, the place kicking and the kickoffs are good. Everything else is at the bottom of the conference.
I do want to give, as Luke alluded to, like Dragan Kesic deserves a lot of credit for yesterday.
Yes.
4 of 5 for a collegiate kicker in those conditions. It was incredibly, incredibly windy at Kinnick Stadium. I asked Dragan after the game, was that the most difficult conditions he's kicked in? And he looked at me and said, without a doubt. Dragan is one of my favorite players on the team. He's got a great personality. I think he's really good at what he does. And Minnesota doesn't win that game without him yesterday. And You just look at the rest of it. And to Derek's point, everybody loves to dunk on Quentin Redding. I've dunked on Quentin Redding. I mean, it's
had a
part
tough
of
year.
The returners. Yeah. I mean, you have two balls just hit the turf, which are we – I don't know that I've seen multiple balls on a kickoff hit the turf before when they're both very fieldable, even at the high school level. Yet here we are in a Big Ten institution in year 7 of the same coordinator, and they can't figure out the wind. Sean Tyler with 3 kickoff return touchdowns. Quentin Redding, who has extensive experience back there. Neither of them can figure out how to field a punt in the wind, a punt or kick in the wind. What? To Derek's point, though, I feel like we haven't talked about enough. Yeah, the first time Q Redding this year makes a guy miss on kickoff return will be the first time. But he also always has somebody on top of him immediately. Yes. And that kickoff return team is not blocking. Mm-hmm. The schemes, the players, whatever it may be, my goodness. You have punt return on a day where Torrey Taylor averages 50 yard per punt. You don't return a single one, and Redding almost muffed 2 of them. And then you've got the coverage units, which Minnesota boots everything out of the end zone now on kickoff because they're not good at covering kicks. And then Cooper DeJean nearly flips the game on his head. I mean, that's where you saw Minnesota make the adjustment yesterday. I don't know if people could see it on the TV copy or not, but they brought Tyler Newbin in on punt to use him.
Yeah, as a gunner.
Had him come across in motion to try and get a head start on trying to get down on Cooper DeJean. And I think it's kind of ironic, I believe, on that final punt of the game where DeJean nearly broke it, where I don't think they used him in that setting because they were trying to do a little corner kick action, which Mark Crawford was fine yesterday. Like, I'm not here to tell you he was great. Yeah, I know the stats look pretty good for him, 39 yards per punt on a day where it's incredibly windy with 5 inside the 20. But you look on the flip side where Torrey Taylor averages 10 more yards per punt, has 4 punts of 50 plus yards. I mean, that's what it looks like, everyone. I almost feel like I can hear it in my voice that I sound defeated at this point, because to your point, Luke, I almost thought maybe there would be a change, but there's nothing that ever changes with special teams. I asked the questions. After the game, Justin Gard is putting his children to bed right now, and he mocked me a little bit. Again, a good jest. I understand that, but like, I'm the only one asking special teams questions. I'm not here to say blame Andy Greeter or Randy Johnson or Chip Scoggins. Don't blame them. That's stupid. Blaming the media and tweets for not asking questions is one of the dumbest things I've ever heard. Again, I'm biased. I'm the media member guy. We ask the questions, but we also don't, when we don't ask a specific question to a coach, it's because we don't believe we're going to get an answer that constitutes even asking the question at this point.
Sure. And my point as a fan on that in saying, like, why is there no conversation about it? I'm not saying that they're not answering the question, but rarely is it covered.
Do I agree with you that I wish more people were talking about it? Yes. Do I think that Fleck thinks it's a problem? I honestly don't. And right. I think that's the problem within the problem is, I mean, peace and love to just the entire return units at this point in year seven. They're high school level. Saying that they are Division III level is an insult to St. Olaf College. Like, you can't return two. Like, you have an opportunity to help your team with field position. They lost 15 yards of field position on three kickoff returns yesterday for their offense against the Iowa Hawkeyes in Kinnick Stadium. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
It would have been 30 yards of field position lost if it wasn't for the targeting call, which, can I be honest and say, I didn't think that was targeting. I thought that was a fine just football hit, but
yeah,
like, you would have lost 30 yards on three kickoff returns. That's an extra 10 yards your struggling offense would have had to have gone. And why this all doesn't make any sense to me, and I'll say it for the umpteenth week, PJ Fleck is a Jim Tressel disciple, and he wants to do three things: dominate time of possession on offense with running the football and conservative nature, wants to be really good on defense, and that means stopping the run, limiting explosive plays, generating. But if that style of play and that rationale is going to work, you have to have competent special teams. I'm not asking for you to be LeVar Woods. I'm asking for you to have competent special teams, and it just never is that way, Derek.
Okay, so this is when you mentioned that, and I believe you, that you think PJ doesn't believe this is an issue. If we just break this down for a second and not look at special teams as a whole, and let's just talk about kick return. This is what where Luke mentioned at the beginning of the show about objectivity. If you had, let's just say your run defense finished last in the Big Ten, and then the following year, the run defense finished second to last in the Big Ten, and the following year, they finished last in the Big Ten, and then the fourth year, they finished last in the Big Ten. Don't you think that objectively you would look at that and say, that's a part or a unit of the team that we have to get better? And I'm not saying they don't believe it needs to get better, but at what point can you not think it's a problem? Because objectively speaking, and this isn't about personally attacking people or players or coaches, it's just if you look at where the kick return and punt return have finished statistically in the conference over the last 7 years, it can't be any worse. So I don't know. I don't understand how that can't be viewed as an issue that needs to be fixed. And maybe they have tried fixing it, but whatever they've tried hasn't worked.
I mean, I literally asked, here's the question I asked Fleck after the game: outside of Dragan, how would you characterize special teams right now? And Fleck essentially just said, you know, and I quote, it's part of the winning formula, but I mean, it's not perfect. I don't think anybody's going to be perfect. Today was a tough day in special teams to be able to judge things. I just think he's not seeing the forest through the trees. Like, he thinks I'm asking that question because of the DeGene thing, which, yes. But also, their return game is so laughable. I mean, you get nothing from your coverage team. Your punt team has been – I agree with you, Derek. I don't think anything changes. I just will believe it when I see it because it's been 7 years of mediocre special teams. Say what it is. I mean, it's
– yeah.
I still can't believe Cooper DeJean got out along the sidelines there, but I also can believe it because that's the way Minnesota special teams impact the game for 7 years, and I don't know. I don't know what else to say at this point. That I think that there should be a change in something, but the more things don't change, the more I believe him on special teams.
All right, let's wrap here. Let's also give Brady Weeks some credit. The guy has snapped really well for the last 4 years that he's been here. He had a good day again yesterday too. In addition to Dragan, he was good as well. If this is your first time listening to Go for Gridiron Radio, we're not always this negative.
Especially after a win 24 years, we'll get more positive here.
We're going to run a quick ad, but then stick with us. We'll talk some offense. We'll definitely talk some Gopher defense. Ryan, it's going to get cold outside this next week, and wouldn't it be nice if you had a maroon bomber jacket to wear to this Michigan State game coming up? Home Field Apparel has one available now. It is awesome, just frankly awesome, and Gopher fans, you need to get on this ASAP because supplies are limited.
Yeah, if you haven't seen the new bomber jacket from Home Field Apparel and homefieldapparel.com, it is fly. I mean, it is fantastic. It is very retro. It's something that you're going to look at and say, Ryan, I have to have today. Well, when you put it into your cart at checkout at homefieldapparel.com, use promo code GG23, get 15% off your first order. That's saving $25 on this bomber jacket. So go to homefieldapparel.com, use promo code GG23 at checkout to get 15% off your first order.
All right, let's talk about this Gopher defense. Fellas, they played real well. Ryan, when we talked about this game coming in, we said, one, this Iowa offense wasn't particularly good. There was some talk about, you know, the improved running game. We tried to say, you know, the advanced stats actually don't support that. The running game struggled, but Minnesota hasn't been great. So what they need to be able to do is shut down this this Iowa rushing attack. And sure as heck, they absolutely did.
They were tremendous against the run. And I know that if you're listening to this, you know the Iowa offense isn't great. I know that as well. I witnessed it. I watched the tape. It's why you're listening to this. But Iowa's running backs had run for over 200 yards the last 2 weeks coming into this. They had been running the ball pretty efficiently. Now, there was a lot of volume within that, certainly, but they were averaging 5, 6, 7 yards a carry. And then yesterday, Minnesota holds them, the Iowa tailbacks, to 20 carries for 33 yards. If that was going to be, if you won this game and finally got off the schneid against Ferentz, finally won since 99 in Iowa City, that's what you're going to have to do is stop the run and make Deacon Hill beat you, which he's, as you saw yesterday, very incapable of doing because he's very erratic, very inconsistent. And for the third straight year, I would say, Derek, what stood out to me was up front, Minnesota dominated again. I mean, you saw, if you look at the Pro Football Focus stats, which are up on Gopher Illustrated, Pro Football Focus graded the following defensive players for the highest graded games of their careers. Jalen Logan Redding, who plays 5 technique, number 97, you saw him on the sack, he played 5 technique and 3 technique. Devin Eastern, who continues to get better and better and better, number 91, starts at 3 technique for them. And then Devin Williams, the linebacker, number 9. All three of them had their highest graded games yesterday. I mean, the front seven for Minnesota just completely shut down the running game. And then, you know, for all the talk about the DeGene play, Iowa still got the ball at their own 46 with 81 seconds left, and all they had to do was kick a field goal to win it. How many times have we seen them do that over the years? But why aren't they able to find success? Because on first down, Danny Strigow gets a sack. On second down, Ja Joyner's pressure gets an errant throw. And then on third down, pressure gets there and Justin Wally gets a pick. The front seven for Minnesota yesterday, Derek, deserves a lot of credit.
Yeah, I think that Pro Football Focus has it right. That was just by the eye test, Devin Eastern's best game by far. Flashed more than he ever has. Jalen Logan Redding was exceptional. I also thought Kyler Baugh was pretty good. He probably didn't get home as much as Devin and Jalen, but as far as providing a push and disruption, I think that was really good. And I think the best evidence of that was two things: getting pressure in the second half, which if we look at the season as a whole, one of the things that's hurt this defense is not getting home on pressure calls. So, and we even saw that in the first half of this game where Joe Rossi has been more willing to call pressures, I think, because he trusts Justin Wally and Tyler Newbin on the back end. But there have been so many times where you bring an extra rusher or you run an exchange blitz and it's just blocked up. And the problem with that is you usually have either man coverage behind it or a soft zone and they're able to complete a pass. Well, it was really nice to see in the second half those pressures were getting home, but then even with four, they started to get a lot of pressure. So huge, huge game out of the defensive line. Best game of the year for offensive line. And then, excuse me, in the pass, and then also in the run, short yardage. I mean, exceptional game and short yardage defense. Some penalties, which Ryan, I know you weren't happy about on the ones touchdown scoring drive for Iowa, but a number of times Iowa was in third and short situations and got stuffed and ended up forcing a punt, which was huge. So I think you're right. The front seven, best game of the year for the defensive line for the Gophers, and both run and pass.
All right, let's mix in some team stats here. You know, on the day, Iowa was 4 of 15 in third down efficiency. They only amassed 127 yards of total offense. Much of that, actually, almost all of that, coming in the first half. If you look at the time of possession too, they only possessed the ball 24 minutes. Something that, you know, they obviously pride themselves on being able to possess the ball. And most importantly, guys, the Gophers forced 3 turnovers, right? And they legitimately forced those turnovers. We had talked about this defense has been more opportunistic this year. They had the opportunity to be with Deacon Hill, who has struggled even in those most recent wins, and they made the most of it. They forced 2 strip sack fumbles. We'll get to the offense inability to execute on those, but also forcing the interception. And the interception was absolutely forced, as you pointed out, Ryan, by Jaw Joyner's pressure, or by pressure from the Gophers. I don't actually remember if that was Jaw Joyner at the moment.
Well, you had Tyler Newbin.
Yeah.
Played, I mean, he, outside of the batting the ball away at the goal line thing to give Iowa a fresh set of downs, I mean, Tyler Newbin showed up in a big game. And you could hear after the game, whether it was his interview with Justin Gard, us with the media, that game meant a lot to him. It's part of the reason why he came back for another year. I mean, he wanted that game bad. And that's where he recovers a fumble that was forced by Devin Williams on a blitz. He forces a fumble on a strip sack. Devin Williams won. I mean, Newbin just played. I mean, to me, Derek, you know, before we get too far into the weeds, I know there's something you want to bring up. We talked about it last night. I think it's a great point. Stevie pointed out by you. But I think it played a huge part in why Minnesota is able to come away yesterday.
I think if you've been a Gopher fan and you've watched the last, let's just call it 4 games against Iowa, you saw a lot of the same, let's be honest. I mean, Minnesota's had success running the ball at times against Iowa's defense. Minnesota's defense has taken away Iowa's consistency on offense almost every time they've played. Part of that is, yes, Iowa's offense just isn't consistent to begin with. Maybe that's probably not part of their strategy, but the number one reason that this game was different to me was the fact that the defense did not give up explosive plays. And I know people are probably looking at this and saying, well, Iowa's not an explosive offense. Well, in 3 out of the last 4 years, they've made just enough explosive plays. They've always gotten Minnesota on either, you know, the tight end drag route or a key play action in the second half of the game, or brought in a gadget play or a misdirection, and they've always caught Minnesota on that, and they didn't this year, and they tried, by the way. So they ran a couple of screens that were sniffed out. They ran a big misdirection play in the second half that Devin Williams saves it. I mean, he reads it, he comes back, he saves it. If not for that, that's an explosive gain, if not a touchdown. So Iowa shot their bullets like they usually do. They play vanilla, 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 and then they pull something. And the difference to me, Ryan, I mean, again, I think that's the difference in the game this year. Why this year ended up being a different outcome than previous years is that the defense just sniffed them out.
You hit the nail on the head. I mean, it's 2021. How does Minnesota lose a game where they dominate for 40 minutes time of possession? Because Charlie Jones hits explosive plays. You look at last year. How does Iowa win the game other than Minnesota's offense? Because they have the Sam Laporta middle screen to the tight end, which they tried again, but mm-hmm. who was there? Devin Williams, and he snuck and he snipped it out. I mean, they hit on some shots last year, which that's what Iowa does. They run the same thing, and that's what Fleck and Rossi talked about this week, was you have to break boring, where they're going to run the same formations and the same plays, and then they're going to try to get you on a gotcha play.
Mm-hmm.
Well, why Minnesota had been 0-6 coming into this game is because they kept getting got on the gotcha plays. There's too many explosives. After that first drive, Minnesota doesn't allow a play, I believe, over 15 yards the rest of the game.
Yeah, they had, so Ryan, just from even from an expected points added perspective, you know, Game on Paper, who I've started following this year, does a phenomenal job of breaking some down some of these stats. But they define an explosive play as an EPA greater, again, expected points added is EPA, greater than 2.4 when passing and 1.8 points when running. Iowa had one, and it was that play in the very first half. Minnesota had two. Neither team was very explosive, but Derek, it's a great astute point by you calling out that, you know, Minnesota was able to stymie explosive plays, and Iowa is just not able to generate them. Additionally, I do think we have to talk about the touchdown drive that the Gophers did give up. Most of that was self-inflicted, right? A lot of those penalties. If you look at where Iowa offensively, where their EPA was highest on offense, it was on penalty EPA, right? Minnesota took really bad penalties in that situation. You know, I'm trying to remember. I should actually just look this up.
Danny Strigo, yeah, exactly. Third down. Minnesota lets Deacon Hill escape. He should have been sacked. Danny Strigo gets his hand on the face pass, nearly rips off his helmet. That can't happen. You have
interference in the end zone.
Yep. Correct. You have Devin Williams come on a run blitz, and he's untouched, and Deacon Hill just sidesteps him instead of a sack. It's a throw to the end zone. PI is called. It's a 25-yard swing where that should have been a sack, a 10-yard loss. Instead, it's a 15-yard gain. Next play, Ja Joyner just jumps off sides at the 6-yard line, and then the Tyler Newbin play where that frankly, one was going to be very, very interesting to me.
Frankly speaking, like, That's another one where you could go letter of the law, spirit of the law. Like, are you supposed to knock the ball out? He actually flips it to the official. I'm not trying to suggest that it shouldn't have been a penalty, but like,
you just have to be smarter there. I mean, you can't. It's the same thing with like Cooper DeJean play. Like, you can't give the refs that gray area.
Exactly.
Just leave the ball where it is and not again. And that's where that play was going to be so interesting to me.
Yes.
Because Kirk Ferentz had punted from midfield twice on 4th and inches, which play to win the game, my man. I hated that decision, but it was going to be 4th and inches at the goal line. Would he have kicked a field goal? Would he have gone for it after getting stuffed twice? I don't know, but I would have loved to have seen what his decision was going to be, because then Newbin essentially just gifts them 6 points there, which is obviously unfortunate.
Yeah, in general, you know, that was obviously the defense's worst outing of, or I should say, series of the game, and ultimately it was self-inflicted. Otherwise, you know, outside of, you know, Kirk Ferentz, or sort of Brian
Ferentz,
Iowa
had negative yards in the second half until their final drive. Like,
right.
Yes, that offense is incompetent, but Minnesota made them more incompetent than usual.
This Minnesota is deserves credit.
Last week against Wisconsin, I've just mentioned it. Their tailbacks ran for over 200 yards against them. And in this game, you ran for 33. If you were going to beat Iowa, that's how you were going to do it, with stopping the run, limiting explosive plays, and then generating 3 turnovers. Because another large part of why you won the game, you were +3 in the turnover margin. And I would imagine if you look at the stats, when you're +3, your win percentage just has to be in the 90s.
Yeah, for sure. And I think the other thing, I want to just give a couple quick shout outs to guys that, you know, we maybe don't talk about a lot. We obviously talk about Newbin, Wally, you know, Maverick Baranowski, Easter.
Maverick played well.
Yeah, I thought so too. But I want to shout out Hender, or not, what's Trayvon's last name? Number 2.
Trey Jones.
Trey Jones. He had a play where he jumped and tipped the ball on a blitz, very heads up play. That would have probably been a completion. I guess we don't know, because it could have been a very errant, poor throw, but a great play by him. I think also he was the one, even on the explosive play, in pretty good position.
He was in the spot. He just didn't make the play.
Didn't make the play. And that's 50-50 balls. And I thought overall, like, he's been a real good addition playing opposite Wally for them. You know, better than not. I just want to make sure he gets some love there as well. And Ryan Seelig a couple different times stepped up and filled holes well. And then have to give number 12, I'm forgetting his name at the moment,
Darius Green.
Holy crap, did he take on that tight end and or fullback and just blow the play up. He ended up going out after that play, but absolutely a big boy play. Kudos to him.
Yeah, I mean, you can point to really anybody on this defense why again, you look at this stats at the end of the day, he only allowed 127 yards of offense, and 70 of those, I believe, came on the opening drive. Yes, Iowa's offense, very incompetent, but I will continue to say you have to make them that way too. Because we saw Northwestern just a month ago. That was an incompetent offense, and Minnesota made them look like the 2023 Miami Dolphins. So that's what, you know, I kind of come back to here to kind of close out. We talked about it on the preview, Luke, that I asked Joe Rossi on Wednesday, what is the current iteration, with this current iteration of the 2023 defense, what are they capable of? Because he loves to talk about how every defense is capable of something different. There's going to be some defenses where their ceiling is really high and some defenses where their floor is really low. And that's where we had seen glimpses of both of those in the first six games of the year. So I asked him, off the bye week, now that you've had time to evaluate, what do you think? What is this 2023 defense to you? And he kind of looked at me, smirked, and said, we'll see. We'll start to find out this weekend. Now, it's a great step in the right direction. You generate three turnovers. You get four sacks, six tackles for loss. You only allow 10 points on the day, and most of it was just self-inflicted by your own self, which I guess if there's solace to take, there's that. But now you got to do it again next week against Michigan State. And then you got to do it again next week against Illinois, because if you're going to continue to try and position yourself to have a shot at the end at the Big Ten West for one last time, this was a great first step. But now you got to do it again next week against Michigan State.
Okay, before we wrap up, Derek, we got to give you some credit. I think it was maybe our last breakdown, you said that you think that the defense, you know, they had some struggles, but they'd find a way and they'd be able to bring it together and improve. And I know this, everyone's going to say, well, it's an asterisk, it's the Iowa offense. But I think you called it, man, that was a much improved Gopher defense on Saturday.
Yeah, I think that's going to be the thing to watch going forward, because, you know, we had speculated that it wasn't really about speed, size, and strength issues on defense, athleticism. It was post-snap reads. That was where they were struggling. And I would say the one thing to look at that they could still do better is their zone drops and passing. I mean, frankly, Iowa dropped three or four passes that should have been completions.
Yeah,
so
good point.
I think they could be tighter on their zone drops. I think they'll work on that. But in the run game, where they had been misreading and being out of gap, that really got cleaned up. And yes, I know people are going to say, well, Iowa's run game is very good. But the point being, they were fundamentally sound with their reads post-snap. And that's something that I thought and still think is going to improve. And why? Because it's experience. That's how you improve that, is just getting reps and seeing those plays over and over again, the different sets and personnel. So that'll be the thing to watch going forward, is this the game that became a turning point for the mental perspective, being able to make those post-snap reads and be less plays where they're out of position, because that's where they've been hurt in the previous games this season, is just giving up those chunk plays because they're out of gap. So it was good to see that guy cleaned up, certainly in the run fits, and it'd be something to look at going forward.
All right, let's get another ad and we'll talk a little bit of Gopher offense. Ryan, again, yard work is aplenty in the fall, and I love to listen to podcasts and music. I have my AirPods in constantly, and honestly, these memory foam ear tips from Comply Foam have been a huge difference for me when it comes to my listening experience.
We've talked about it now for weeks. We've talked about it now for months. You've already invested in wireless earbuds or just earbuds in general. Well, do yourself a favor and get some of these Comply Foam memory foam tips. The silicone ones, they cause pain in your ear. When you take them out, it hurts. I know it. Or you're constantly adjusting when you're working out, you're mowing the lawn, or if you're just wearing them around the house. So what you need to do is go to complyfoam.com. I've got Beats. Luke's got AirPods. My wife has different brands, and so does Luke's. Find your brand. Get some of these memory foam ear tips today. They're complyfoam.com. They're a local company, and you'd be helping support us as well. So with your first order, you get 20% off. That is 20% off your first order. Find your memory foam tips today, and when you get to checkout, use promo code GG23 and save 20% today.
Ryan, you mentioned going into this game that the Gopher offense had been improving in the red zone. That wasn't necessarily the case today, but I'll tell you what, man, they did just enough and they were able to execute just enough. I imagine we're going to be somewhat critical in this section, but we do have to get into it. Minnesota amasses 12 points on the day, no touchdowns to their name, no touchdowns to their resume, but they did just enough to get this Gopher victory.
I'd say the most positive thing that the offense did yesterday was not turn over the football.
Yeah.
And I think that's important to note because we talked about it in the preview. If you were going to beat Iowa, you know what this offense has done historically in this game? Shoot themselves in the foot in big spots. You look at last year, Mo Ibrahim unfortunately fumbles at the Iowa 13-yard line when Minnesota looks like they're about to score. Instead of no points, or instead of seven, instead of three, you get zero. You look at with that next drive from Minnesota last year in 2022. Ethan throws a pick. It's deflected up in the air. Jack Campbell returns it. I mean, you shot yourselves in the foot. Now, were there opportunities there? I think Daniel Jackson maybe had the most game-saving of plays when Ethan threw a pass and it hit the Iowa Hawkeye defensive lineman directly square in the face mask and popped up 25 feet in the air, and Daniel Jackson put on his best corner skills and deflected it down. But the offense did enough, and that's still a really good Iowa defense. I'm not here to tell you otherwise. I thought they were pretty dang good, but when they needed to make a play, Ethan finally calmed himself down enough, got his mechanics in order, and found Daniel Jackson deep down the field, which Daniel Jackson is the other positive from yesterday. Daniel Jackson was open consistently. And when you look at his stat line of 7 catches for 101 yards, it's believable, and it's not fluky to me because he was consistently open all day long. So if we're going to start with positives, Derek, I think Daniel Jackson did a good job, and Minnesota didn't turn over the football.
Yeah, I think that on the positive train for offense, this was the best I've seen the Gopher wide receiving core play against Iowa. Iowa That's schematically – Yeah, I think, well, in the past few years, I mean, in this, I guess, era, if you want to call it that. And it might sound a little bit head scratching because there was problems on the execution side. So what I mean by that is there were more receivers running open in the Iowa secondary than I'd seen in the past. Okay. Iowa, let's be clear, their secondary is as good as anybody in the conference at coverage, their defense in general. And schematically, Iowa used more varied coverages in this game than I had seen them use before. Usually they're pretty much a man under two press team day in, you know, play in and play out. They mixed in a lot more single high man coverage. They mixed in a lot more quarters coverage. I actually thought the play calling from a passing perspective was pretty good. Again, issues in execution, but I, again, saw more wide receivers running open in the secondary than I had seen previously. I think that's a credit to the receivers. I think that Daniel Jackson was the one that played the best. Corey Crooms, I mean, we could have the argument about whether they were drops or poor throws. He was open quite a bit.
Yes.
Didn't come away with it, but he was open quite a bit. And then the mixing in the running backs in the past game was a revelation, something we've been calling on. So, you know, that flood pass against zone to Darius Taylor, they utilized that for a huge first down in the second half. So, yeah, starting off with the positive, I would say, you know, in the passing game, the receiving core looked pretty good. They do need to definitely get things turned around, though, as far as executing.
Yeah, there's no question there that the execution needs to be better. The other thing that we probably should comment on, it is hard to throw in those kind of conditions. There was a ball or two that I was like, I wonder if the wind affected those. I'm not trying to make an excuse for Ethan Kaliak-Manis with that, but it can be challenging. It also can be challenging from a reception perspective, especially if the ball kind of it doesn't knuckle per se, but it just does things that are a little bit obscure. We saw that both with the Iowa receivers, and I think Corey Crooms just straight up dropped one as well. In general, I agree with you that the Gophers did a good job of scheming guys open, and the execution was the part that was, you know, probably the most frustrating. But in general, what I was encouraged by was the third quarter approach with the wind at their back. They did come out throwing the ball. They found more success offensively, obviously, in the second half. And even when they were able to throw the ball, you know, Ethan did have a couple just great throws too, that, you know, that that deep 15 yard stop or comeback to Daniel Jackson, just an absolute dime of a ball there. In general, I liked the approach. I'm curious your guys' thought in that, especially in that third quarter. That's how I want them to play going forward.
It just seems like there's always, you don't know from drive to drive. It feels like, is Greg Harbaugh calling the plays, or is PJ Fleck overriding him with his risk averseness? Like, you don't know what you're, I mean, what you, it was funny. Once Minnesota took the lead 12-10, the group chat between the three of us immediately became, here comes the turtle, when Fleck did turtle. But it's, you don't know what you're going to get from drive to drive in terms of who's really directing the signals here. I don't think there was invalid signals between the Minnesota offense. I think they were valid. Do you like my little shot there? Anybody else pick that?
I actually got that. I was going to, I don't have like a rim shot here to mix in.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And again, long night, early morning is what it is. But you just want to see the head coach one day when you get a 12-10 lead, not just turtle. I mean, they did try and throw on that second down out of an interesting formation there, which from my eyes and on the rewatch, it doesn't look like there was a lot open there. But, I mean, there's a lot of things that you see on the Twitter machine or Gopher Illustrated about blaming the offensive coordinator. I don't know how many times, Derek, I have to continue to say this. I don't think it matters who the offensive coordinator is, whether it's Kirk Sciacca, Mike Sanford, or Greg Harbaugh. There are going to be points in every single game where you know the head coach is going to take over, and this is what it's going to be. But they were having more success in that second half. They did have 174 total yards. They did score 9 points against that Iowa defense. Now, they were gifted some of it with some turnovers, but any more thoughts there?
Yeah, I mean, the approach in the first half was definitely to stay collected and stay, you know, conservative is probably too strong of a word, but they weren't taking a lot of shots. Now, the first play of the game, they had the right call against the right coverage. Iowa goes what I think was quarters coverage. They commit their two safeties to run, and they had Corey Crooms wide open on a post down the middle of the field. Well, shouldn't say wide open, against single coverage.
He was
wasn't
open,
able to.
Yeah, single coverage. Yeah.
So again, they did, I think, take some calculated shots in the first half. But as long as I think Minnesota was going to be either tied or up, I think they were going to play it very close. And I've been the one the last few years really banging the drum and saying, you need to be more aggressive against Iowa. You need to be more unconventional. I got to say, with the way they struggled executing in the pass, I kind of understood it, that you're going to play it close. But if you're going to play it close like that, you have to open up later. I don't think you can play the whole game like that. And that's where the third quarter became key. And I agree with Luke that they got down a score because Iowa got the score right before the first half ended. So the third quarter, down a score, wind at your back. If that wasn't the time to be aggressive, there was no time. So they did come out throwing on running situations and with some success. And I think that helped them get back in the game. They only ended up with field goals, to your point, Ryan. But I think that helped them to be aggressive and more calculated. I think, to talk out of both sides of my mouth, if they had been throwing wildly the whole game, the way Iowa was mixing coverages, you really worry about an interception there. So. Yeah. There maybe was some wisdom in playing it close, but you can't do that the whole game, and I don't think they did. So I think the approach was okay. I agree with you, Ryan, that you know, once they get a second half lead, I understand being somewhat conservative, but you have to be a little bit more unconventional. It's just so easy to defend that when you're going to run inside zone, zone read. You know, it's the defense is. You know, they're going to run quarters coverage. They're going to bring their two safeties down. You're plus two in the they're plus two in the box. It's just really hard to move the ball. So I'd like to see that change.
Well, here's one thing I want to transition to is I've been getting a lot of tweets about it. You've been getting a lot of tweets about it. A lot of talk about it on Gopher Illustrated, which once again, just a dollar for their to get you up until the Wisconsin game if you want to come hang out with us. But Ethan Kaliak-Manis, very inconsistent again from series to series. play to play at times. Now, I don't want to steal the thunder of Derek Burns. It's something that him and I have talked a ton about in the last 24 hours. And I think his thoughts are very much kind of spot on in terms of here's where Ethan is struggling. Here's where he's doing well. So if you had to sum up what you've seen of late from the quarterback, how would you sum it up, Derek?
Yeah, I tried to take an extra dive into this when looking at the film, at the Iowa film. And so a couple things stood out to me. I think that, first of all, where Ethan has done well is throwing into stationary routes. So hitches, stops, comebacks, where the receiver isn't moving horizontally or laterally. He's able to uncork and throw full speed at those routes, and he does pretty well there. You know, Luke, you mentioned the comeback or the hitch in the second half to mm-hmm. Daniel Jackson became a key. That's an example of a route that Ethan's thrown very well. I think he uses his whole body. His footwork is good. And again, he has the arm talent to make those throws into a tight window. What I see mechanically with him that has been causing him problems is that when he has to put touch on the ball, his arm is so strong that he doesn't use his lower body when throwing the pass. So he tries to throw it only with his arm, which you end up kind of aiming the ball, which affects your accuracy. So things like shallow crosses, slants, cross country route, which he did throw successfully once in the second half, corner routes, things like that. That's where he's had struggles, is hitting a left to right, right to left moving target where he has to take some velocity off the ball and it's more of a touch pass. And why I think that's he's struggling with that is, again, with his arm strength, he is trying to lean back or not step into the throw, and that's affecting his accuracy. So I think that I'm guessing the coaches have probably identified this, and if you've heard Coach Fleck talk either in you know, weekly press or post game, whatever, he's talked a lot about his footwork and stepping into his passes. So I think they're trying to work with him on it. But it's, you know, when you get into the heat of the game, you fall back into bad habits or bad tendencies. So I think that going forward, what you probably want to work on with him is you have to step into those throws. If that means you have to throw those a little bit harder, then so be it. But you don't want to just throw those with your arm and try to aim those throws. And you have to be careful with your mechanics. So I think to sum it up, that's what's, you know, there's not one thing. There, you know, sometimes the pre and post snap reads aren't always there. And with a young, relatively young player, that's to be expected. But mechanically, I think that's what they have to hone in on and continue working on and to develop those touch passes.
I think the only thing I'll add to that isn't necessarily to disagree with Derek's assessment, because I agree with it 100%. But from my perspective, as someone who also covers this team and kind of roster construction and recruiting and things like that, where I'm kind of at with Ethan now is he's got, what is it, 5 more regular season games and then a bowl game. I am going to be, say, optimistic in saying Minnesota wins 2 of their next 5 games to find themselves getting an extra 15 practices and getting to a bowl game. You got 5 to 6 more games to prove that there are more flashes there and there's more consistency there, so that when the portal does become open, that, you know, that your coaching staff isn't going to go balls to the walls to try and find a really good transfer quarterback potentially to come in and push you. You've got, I mean, I would argue that, you know, they should probably bring in a transfer quarterback regardless, but I think for him, it's going to be you have to show over the next 6 games progress, tangible, feasible progress, that these mechanical things that Derek is mentioning, and it's something that offensive coordinator Greg Harbaugh has talked about with pocket movement and trying to get all the things from footwork to stepping into throws to touch to whatever it may be to really show throughout a consistent 60-minute game against a Big Ten competition. So that's what I'm going to be very interested to see going forward is I think the physical, as I said before the season, I think he is the most physically talented quarterback that they've had, but mm-hmm. it is so entrenched in so many different issues right now And now I know that Iowa does that to a lot of people. Iowa's defense does that to a lot of people. But it's these upcoming games against less stout defenses like Michigan State, like Illinois, like Purdue, like Wisconsin. Like, these aren't world-beating defenses, and you have to be able to show progress, because if you don't, then you're going to be putting this coaching staff in a spot where they, I mean, they feel very good about what they have in their high school quarterback, Drake Lindsey. He's been sensational down in Arkansas thus far. But it's bringing in competition, because I don't know that anyone expects Cole Kramer to come back. And if he does, I mean, why would you want to come back and be the quarterback too? And go play at St. Thomas or whatever it may be and go, you know, do something like that. And that's where I see your tweets. I see the threads on Gopher Illustrated about, is he really the best option? I'm going to tell you, yes. You, like, even at a season right now where you're 4-3, what would be the point in putting Cole Kramer in there? Because I can assure you he's not the better quarterback in practice. What are you gaining in putting a six-year guy there? Drew Vioto is a true freshman. You don't want to have any part of that with the remaining six games of the year. So this is a big next six games for Ethan to prove, coming in the last few seasons, the belief in this program has been he is the future. He's going to be the one that really takes us to the next level. I think Cali McManus has got six more games to really prove that if that's going to remain true, you got to show progress.
All right, we got to talk a little bit about the run game. We haven't done much of that yet. On the day, the Gophers didn't run the ball particularly well. You know, as a team, 45 carries, 113 yards, 2.5 yards per carry. You know, Darius Taylor averaged 3.7 yards a carry. Zach Evans probably looked best at 10 carries and 44 yards at a 4.4 yard clip. But in general, the run game wasn't phenomenal. You got to give Iowa credit. Their defensive line obviously played quite well, and their safeties came down hard. Sebastian Castro was as good as advertised, I would say. In general, Derek, what did you see from the offensive line in terms of execution? I think for me, in the first half, it was really lacking.
Yeah, I think the offensive line was okay. I was a physical front. I think that what was worked well in the run game was mid zone, and then really mid zone out of that toss, which they kind of, they want that to look like outside zone, but that's actually a cutback play, which is something new they showed for this Iowa game. I thought it worked really well for them. So believe it or not, getting their running backs in a little more space and getting a little more stretch out of the defense, I think is what worked better. But, you know, my only criticism, and it's a mild criticism on play calling for the day, was I didn't like how in the second half they went back to too much inside zone, in my opinion. I thought they should have stuck with more mid zone in that toss play and worked play action off of that in the, you know, in the second half. They seem to go back to a more zone read, more RPO and inside zone, which again, against Iowa's front, is just, you're really running uphill at that point, because they're going to be post snap, they're going to be plus one or two in the box. So I think, you know, again, so to answer your question, Luke, physically, I thought both fronts for Minnesota, offensive and defensive line, were pretty physical, but it wasn't entirely clean. It wasn't their best game against a tough front. And, you know, I think going forward, it would be interesting to see if they continue to work that stretch play in mid zone and maybe work some play action off of that, because that's where I thought they had the most success.
Well, I think they're going to have to, because the big storyline for me from this game is the health. I mean, yep. We saw Zach Evans leave the game, gets ruled out. I don't know that I'm expecting him to play next week. Darius Taylor gets 16 carries, and then Sean Tyler's the one finishing the game. Why? Certainly looked like Darius Taylor might have tweaked whatever that hamstring or whatever an injury was before. Now, I mean, I would tell you after the game, once Minnesota had won, Taylor was jumping around out there. Evans was in street clothes, but he was moving around. I think there's a real possibility next week for Michigan State. You're on RB4 and RB5 and RB6. And the issue is, this isn't 2021 where RB4 is Marquise Williams, who's now starring at Oregon, and Kai Thomas is an RB5.
You mean Marquise Irving?
Yeah, Marquise Irving, excuse me.
You're welcome.
Bucky Irving, yeah. And so if you go into next week, what's it looking like? Because Bryce Williams is now out for the season, which we found out 2 hours before the game. So you're down to your potential top three running backs, RB4 is Sean Tyler, which I know this fan base doesn't like him, but he's run for over 3,000 yards in the FBS level. I think Minnesota's got to do a much better job of getting him to the edge, getting him in space. You don't want to see number two running between the A, B, and C gaps. You want to get him out in space where he can one cut and get to the second level. If it's not going to be Sean Tyler, now we start to get to the walk-ons. I think you saw Jordan Newbin get in there, Tyler Newbin's younger brother. I think he would be your between the tackles guy potentially, maybe someone like walk-on Max Grand. And there's just not a ton more running backs there. You do have true freshman Marquise Williams, but it certainly seems like to me Jordan Newbin is at least ahead of him on the depth chart. So there's a real possibility, Luke, that next week against Michigan State, your starting tailbacks are Sean Tyler and then Jordan Newbin in late October, which, again, we'll see what I hear on both of those running backs, Darius Taylor and Zach Evans. But for those of you looking for anything from the head coach, every single time we ask an injury question, he looks at us, smirks, and says, "You'll find out 2 hours before the game."
Yeah, so let's talk just a little bit about, let's make the assumption that Darius Taylor and Zach Evans might not play in this upcoming game. Like, are we going to see a revert back to the Nebraska game where they throw the ball 44 times? You know, like, I don't know what you're going to see. I think for Michigan State, they're going to be just guessing like anyone.
I guess that's in theory where you may have some theory advantage. Because what do you do if you don't have your top three running backs? What does the offense look like? Is Ethan actually going to throw 25, 30 times in that game then? I don't know. I mean, Derek, if let's operate under the assumption that next week Sean Tyler is your starting running back. What running schemes are you dialing up if you're Greg Harbaugh to try and best utilize his skill set?
Well, I would agree with what you said. It's getting him to the edge or near the edge, somewhere to utilize his speed. I think Sean is a straight ahead runner. I think if I had to change anything, I don't think he looks for the cut early enough. On a lot of the times that play is best when it's you plant your foot in the ground and go north and south. And I think Sean likes to press the edge more, which if you're looking for a home run hitter, that would be the guy, because if you get a back that presses the edge a lot, it can be frustrating because you get 2 yard gain, 2 yard gain, 2 yard gain. But if he can get to the edge and beat one defender, it's a home run. So if you're looking for some optimism, I think that's what you have to do is probably get him more in space, get him out towards the tackle tight end area. Minnesota really hasn't run a true outside zone much of it. It's been mainly mid zone. So maybe you see them add that to it. But I think ultimately, if you're asking what Minnesota does if they're starting RB4, I think they replace a lot of those runs with short passes, which is kind of what they did in the Nebraska game, where you end up throwing stop routes to the tight end, you end up throwing slot stops, and you know those are 4 or 5 yard passing routes that you hope you can break a tackle and make them a 12 yard gain, just in the same way that you hope a 4 yard run can become an 8 to 12 yard run with a broken tackle. So that's probably a strategy they might be looking at. I don't think you're going to see a holistic change to philosophy, but just replacing some of those. And I would just say, I know people get angry when there's a lot of speculation around injury, but you know, with Darius Taylor being that's a soft tissue, I would speculate that even if he's able to play, you really have to be careful to limit his snaps, because you don't come from, you know, a soft tissue injury 1 week to running the ball 35 times. And if you do, you're playing with fire. So I think we are looking at some form of change at the running back position next week.
Ryan, once again, Burns Insurance brings you Gopher Gridiron Radio. Again, Ryan, I don't know if you know this. I grew up on a farm. I was out there this weekend, and guess what? I saw a plenty of deer, and guess what else I saw? I saw one of the guys who works with my dad had already hit a deer, and I gave him your dad's contact information and said, "Hey, buddy, if you don't have a good insurance agent after this, make sure you reach out to Burns Insurance."
it's getting to that time of year where you're hitting deer. Even my father just hit a deer, and he's been working with himself, obviously, as the independent insurance agent then located in downtown Oakdale, Minnesota. Now, if you're not from the great state of Minnesota and you're thinking, well, I still want to make sure I'm getting the best coverage at the best price today, he's licensed in both of the Dakotas, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Iowa, Michigan, New York, Florida, and Utah. So if you are looking at your auto, your home, your commercial, your UTV, whatever it may be, think I'm paying too much or I don't think I have enough coverage, give a local Gopher fan your business today. Get a free quote by going to insurancebyburns.com, or you can email him at bill@insurancebyburns.com.
All right, guys, I think that this in this last segment before we talk about the Big Ten games, which it's going to be fun to talk through those as well, we put a little capstone on the fact that Minnesota has finally won and is bringing back the Floyd of Rosedale. My wife actually was flipping through her phone, finding pictures of the previous times that Floyd has been back, both in 2014, I think also 2011. She showed me a few different photos. I'll tell you, I had more hair, and that was an interesting thing to behold. But let's get into that. You know, Minnesota wins 12-10. Ryan, the under hit, the lowest point total under hit once again. And I think in general, we just have to savor the fact that, you know, Minnesota finally wins the Pig.
I feel like that's getting lost in all this discussion. And even all three of us are guilty of it. We spent the first 30 minutes of an episode where you won against the Iowa Hawkeyes talking about critical things. But I feel like I've seen this discourse too much in the last 24 hours where, you know, we can say things like this, but you, the fan, if you're upset as a Golden Gopher football fan that it wasn't aesthetically pleasing, like, when are you going to find joy in your team winning a football game? I understand it wasn't great. I said before, and I screwed it up, you know, that game was like putting lipstick on a pig. But if you're going to do that, you might as well take the damn pig home with you back to Dinkytown. We have seen so many times, especially recently, where I'd argue the better team didn't win the game. In 2021, Minnesota, 40 minutes time of possession, and they just get killed by explosive plays. In 2022, Mo Ibrahim goes nuclear, you find a way to lose the game. Minnesota found a way to win the game, regardless of the DeJean thing. You win for the first time in Iowa City in 24 years. You have the Axe and the Pig in Dinkytown at the same time for the first time since 93. And you beat B.J. Fleck, gets his first win against Kirk Ferentz for the first time in now 7 years. Like, if you're not finding joy in that, what are we doing here? Like, I cover this team and I understand the idiosyncrasies of how maligned this fan base is and how it's not easy to be a Gopher football fan, and it hasn't been for largely my entire existence on this earth in 31 years. So if you are having a hard time finding joy in this game, take a deep breath, step away, and think about how it feels down 4.5 hours south of you in Iowa City, where they're thinking to themselves, we should have won that game. Well, your team finally won. Your team still got a shot at the Big Ten West because they won this game. And now you have both of your biggest rivalry trophies in the same building for the first time in 30 years. I just want people to understand the moment. It's okay to be frustrated with this team. But if you're not finding joy and happiness that they finally got off the schneid, I'd encourage you to watch some of the interviews with the players after the game. That's why a lot of you are college football fans.
Yeah. It's
because you buy into these 17 to 23 year old kids. And I cannot express to you the elation on their face or listening to Nathan Bowe talk about how he's got Blaze Andres and Connor Olson and Sam Schluter on FaceTime because that's what those guys wanted for so long and they finally got off the schneid. Hear Tyler Newbin break up and get emotional in his post-game interview with Justin Gard talking about how emotional this game is. Emotion is the best part of college football, and that's where these players and these coaches were feeling. And if you're not feeling it yourself, take a deep breath, step back, and remember, Derek, you did win the game.
Yeah, as a I'm really careful to, you know, what I try and suggest to fans, because their fan experience is unique for everybody. But I'll just speak for myself. I love college football. As a former player, I enjoy being a fan now, and because I love the college football experience. And what is the college football experience? Well, one of those things, rivalries, is just huge. And if you live in Minnesota or were born in Minnesota or just are a Minnesota fan for another reason, who knows, you really, I think, felt it this week that there was a lot of people really wanted this. And that's something that's, I think, really think is unique to the sport. There are other reasons in other sports to get excited about big games, but I think that what I try and tell myself is, you know, be careful not to get distracted by the national talk of who's doing what in a division and rankings. And I understand that's important, and I understand there's also an entertainment value to that as well. But I just hope that we don't lose one of the reasons that college football is special, and that is rivalries and fan bases and geography. And Luke, I'm not going to totally steal your thunder, but I know I love how you, when this comes up, you always speak about shared experiences. And so thinking back to, well, where were you and what were you doing the night that Minnesota pulled off an upset win at Iowa on basically a last second or last possession, you know, last 5 minutes victory? I mean, that's the stuff we'll be talking about and we'll be remembering and laughing about and enjoying. And that's special. That shared experience or created memory is awesome.
Yeah, no doubt. I couldn't have said it any better myself. And you know what? It's also okay. Like I know there's discourse all over about whether the play was correctly called, the Cooper DeJean one. You can also just revel in the fact that, you know, this is making Iowa fans mad. Just think of all the times that, you know, they basically went after you saying it's been so long since you've won the Pig. Well, go ahead, revel in it. It's fine. This is what makes it fun. The discourse is fun. The fact we don't agree, yeah, that's fun, right? Like, it's okay. You know, you're never always going to be right about something. And frankly, you're never always going to be on the winning side. So enjoy it while it lasts. I think everybody can enjoy it for the entire year now. And then we'll play again next year and see who comes out on top. Other games we should talk about in the Big 12, or the Big 12. Man, it's actually the Big 14, but we call it the Big 10.
Did you think you were watching Big 12 offenses last night?
No, but I did.
I certainly didn't.
Boy, you want some whiplash, though, boys? Washington only scored 15 points last night against Arizona State. So if you guys want to say, like, hey, the offense was terrible, yada, 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 in the Big 10 West, well, no one's immune, fellas. No one's immune. All right, let's talk a little bit about the Big Ten games. Obviously, we talked about this Minnesota-Iowa game. Maybe let's start with the blowouts and work our way towards the more interesting games. Michigan, 49-0, fellas. A game that Michigan State allegedly thought they maybe wouldn't play. I frankly think that whole conspiracy is much to do about nothing. But in general, 49-0. They couldn't get four consecutive quarters with 14 points, only seven in the fourth. But you guys, Michigan's the real deal.
Yeah, I mean, they're tremendous. I know it was a tumultuous week. I will continue to say, I don't think, regardless, Jim Harbaugh is the coach of the Michigan Wolverines in 2024. I just think there's too much smoke, and there has been for some time, that I think he heads to the NFL. This is his best team. I think there's some NCAA things kind of be coming down against him probably in 2024, at least the football program. But in the meanwhile, they're just going to continue to eviscerate anyone they go against. And that's what Minnesota's next opponent, Michigan State, saw. And I would say, Derek, arguably the most important thing I took from this game is Michigan State's best offensive player got 19 touches on him against a Michigan Wolverine defense. So maybe he's a little bit banged up coming into this game, but what did you take from your Michigan Wolverine experience in a rivalry?
Yeah, I watched most of the first half, and I think that the comment I have, not breaking any ground here, is in a year where there seems to be quite a bit of variance with those the way that those top 12 teams are playing. Again, take a step back. Several of the last years in college football, you've had 2 to 4 teams that are just in another level, and everybody else is behind them. I think there's more variance 1 through 12, with the exception of Michigan. They're the team that just seems methodical. They're dominant. They don't always do it right away. They don't tend to, and I think that's on purpose. That's schematic. They kind of wait back for the first quarter and a half, see what you're doing, try some different things on offense. And, you know, by the second quarter, midway through the second quarter, they kind of unleash the hounds and just, they suffocate you on defense. They find ways to get explosive plays on offense, and nobody's been able to stop them yet. So I think they continue to be the national title favorite in my mind. And it was just more of that on Saturday for them.
All right, let's talk a little bit about Northwestern Nebraska. Northwestern moves to 4-3 on the season, 2-2 in the Big Ten with a 17-9 win. You know, Northwestern was without their starting quarterback. You know, they put up a gallant fight, but I tell you guys, this Nebraska defense is legit. We saw that from the first game. Matt Rhule is a real competent coach. I really think that Nebraska's on the come up, Ryan.
Don't look now, but Nebraska's won 4 of their last 5 games. Don't look, because if you're a Gopher fan, what you want to have happen is Nebraska plays spoiler, especially in their final 2 games of the year, which is on the road in Madison and then Black Friday at home against the Iowa Hawkeyes. You're going to need them to at least beat Iowa. Now, we'll see how Wisconsin continues to trend, and we'll get to them and their fourth quarter comeback. But Nebraska's defense is going to hold them. And you look at the upcoming offenses they go against: Purdue, Michigan State, Wisconsin, Iowa, and Maryland. I mean, I'd argue Maryland is certainly the best of those, but Nebraska is going to be in all these games, and you are going to need them on Black Friday to do what they did last year, and that's beat Iowa. And if they do, that's going to make that Axe Trophy game potentially a lot more interesting.
It's going to be interesting, that Black Friday game, even if no matter what the implications are for the division, because of the matchup's going to be interesting, because you have two really good defenses and you have two offenses that, for I think different reasons, have really struggled. And I think both coaching staffs are very solid. So that's going to be one to watch. It's going to be an interesting chess match.
All right, let's talk a little bit about the Rutgers game against Indiana. So Rutgers gets bowl eligibility with their 6th win of the year. They move to 6-2, 3-2 in the Big Ten. They win 31-14 over Tom Allen's Indiana Hoosiers, who moved to 2-5, 0-4 in the Big Ten. Kudos to Rutgers, right? This is a fan base that hasn't seen a lot of success since moving into the Big Ten. And they're going to hit a gauntlet here in the Big Ten East. But more importantly, for that fan base, it's awesome that they're going to go bowling. They've earned it this time, rather than, you know, getting to opt in, because I can't remember the exact reason, but they got in as a 5-win team a couple of years ago and got an invite because of some other team couldn't participate. But, you know, kudos to them. I think that's just awesome that they finally get a bowl win. And Indiana's struggling, Ryan, but ultimately they took care of business.
Yeah, you're just saying that because you're going to win your bet with me, even though Indiana's going to be exactly where I thought they were. They're 0-4 in conference. But Rutgers scores 31 points, Luke, and they had 39 passing yards.
Yeah.
Like, Rutgers just killed them on the ground. I mean, they're starting running back in 109 yards. Gavin Wimsett ran for 143 yards and 3 scores. And then Joe Harris-Simiak's defense, 9 passes defended in this game against Indiana. Good to see Kirk Shiraka and Joe Harris-Simiak are doing well. Now it gets tough for Rutgers. They got Ohio State next week. They're on the road at Iowa, on the road at Penn State, and finish with Taulia Tagovailoa. So it's certainly going to be, after the bye week for them, a November to remember.
All right, I didn't get to watch any of this game, but I want to get your guys' input. I don't even know if either of you guys did either. Wisconsin wins 25-21 in Champaign, Illinois. This is a game that that Illinois had been up early. They're up actually 21-7 going into the fourth quarter. Wisconsin scores 18 unanswered in the fourth, including at the 27-second mark, a pass from the quarterback to a Nolan Rucci, an offensive lineman, for a 3-yard touchdown. I don't know the implications there. There's some controversy around this. I don't know if either of you got a chance to watch this, but man, what a game. 18 unanswered, Derek.
Yeah, unfortunately, I didn't get a chance to watch much of it, but I did follow the score line and saw that I think Illinois was leading almost the entire game. They almost went into halftime up 14-0, but Wisconsin snuck in a touchdown right before half. And 18, I mean, the storyline is 18 points by Wisconsin in the fourth quarter. So I think that if you're a Gopher fan, what you have to ask is this a change in Wisconsin's passing offense? Their quarterback breaks his hand or has a fracture, goes out. And if they're able to come back the way they did in this game in a short period of time, is this something, you know, I know they've been trying to emphasize passing the ball, and I think people have probably incorrectly referred to it as air raid, but they're trying to change their passing schemes. Do they have something here? Is this something that's changed going forward where they're going to be able to pass the ball more effectively? Because up until now, it's been fits and starts for them passing. So I think that's something to look at.
Much to the chagrin of Justin Gard, the Jim Leonard revenge game, which Jim Leonard is an analyst for the Illinois Fighting Illini, and also the Brett Bielema revenge game didn't exactly go as planned, because you're up 21-7, you score a touchdown, and then you allow, if you're the Illini defense, scoring possessions on the final three of the game, a field goal, a touchdown, all 10-plus play drives. When you needed your defense to get a stop, they couldn't do it. When you needed your offense to be able to get first downs to put this game away, you couldn't do it. You had a five-play, six-play, five-play drive. And this is just going to be one potentially you look back on as we get closer and closer to late November. If Wisconsin doesn't win the West, if Wisconsin does win the West, this is one you're going to be looking back on. But Braylon Allen, I think he had over 100 yards after contact on a day where he gets 29 more carries. I mean, I'm still going to believe it when I see it, that when this game happens between Minnesota and Wisconsin at the end of the year, if Braylon Allen continues to get another 30 touches on his body as we continue to get colder and colder here, I mean, we'll see what it looks like for that Wisconsin offense. But good on the second string quarterback there, their transfer, Braden Locke, for not turning over the football. Excuse me, he did. I'm an idiot. He had a fumble lost. But Wisconsin comes back 18 unanswered in that fourth quarter, and they're now 3-1 in conference.
All right, so everybody was paying attention to the big noon kickoff featuring the Ohio State Buckeyes taking on the Penn State Nittany Lions. Ohio State wins this game 20-12. I think most would be surprised by the score and how low scoring it was. I think as we talked in the preview, Ryan, I did take Ohio State in this game, saying that I just thought that, you know, this defense, this front seven was better, and James Franklin just never found a way to win the game. But my goodness, I didn't get to watch all of it, but the parts I did, Ohio State's front seven came to play, Derek.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah, I think that. No, go ahead, Brian.
Well, I was just going to say, like, you look at that final play where they really put the game out of reach. It's Penn State's star left tackle, top 10 pick, getting beat by the number one overall recruit in the country, and JT, I'm not going to even try to pronounce that last name. The front seven, Derek, just dominated, and I think that played a big part of why Penn State was god-awful on third down.
Yeah, that was, I think, two things that were the difference in the game. I think that Ohio State's quarterback struggled, which is what kept this closer. I'm not trying to take away the fact that Penn State has a solid defense, but I was really impressed by Ohio State's wide receivers, who aren't always interested in playing every Saturday. They were interested in playing this Saturday, but the quarterback, I think, kept it a little more interesting. And then on the flip side, I think that was the difference. Ohio State's defense and their ability to get pressure is what kept this low scoring for Penn State. I do have to give a Captain Obvious statement, just because I was so impressed. Marvin Harrison Jr., wow.
Yeah,
he's the best player in college football.
Yeah, that gentleman is impossible to guard. When he is interested and wants to play, whether it's deep routes or even they threw to him underneath a number of times, and holy moly, he is very extremely athletic and fast. And so, again, that Ohio State wide receiver core, they showed up, and I think with a little bit better quarterback play, this one could have been 35-40 points for Ohio.
Yeah. Drew Aller on the day, the Penn State quarterback, really struggled as well. Well, Kyle McCord wasn't that bad. I just think he missed opportunities. The execution wasn't there. He wasn't super bad.
I would agree.
Yeah.
Yep.
But Drew
statistically, I don't think it was awful. I'm not suggesting he was throwing interceptions and such, but he missed a number of open throws. Just, yes. They just weren't there.
For sure. Drew Aller on the day, though, was 18 of 42 for 191 yards. That just wasn't a great showing for him. In general, I feel for Penn State fans. I'm sure James Franklin is getting some heat on this one as well. But in the end, they weren't able to get it done. It's still a very entertaining game. The parts I got to watch, I'm actually hoping to be able to get back to finish that one and see the thing in whole, in totality. But yeah, just a great day of college football. It's always just awesome when we have college football games, guys. And there are some interesting storylines developing as the season goes on. The West, as much as people want to dump on it, is just getting all the more interesting once again. It's going to be as wild as it has ever been. And it'll just be fun to follow here through the end of October and into, you know, the really meaningful November. So I'm going to ask you, Derek, just one last time. You had the opportunity to play college football and play in the Big Ten. But you've always talked about the importance of November as we're nearing it here and what it means to the conclusion of the season.
Yeah, I think that we talk about this each year, and I think it's still important, and that's trajectory. I mean, there's a lot of emphasis put on schedule. So, you know, do you play your more difficult games in November, or does your schedule ease up? I think for sure that's a factor. I think health now is much more important than it used to be, because I think there are more injuries. I just think the injury rate is higher. But there's this thing called trajectory, and I still believe in it. And it's the teams that generally are playing better going into November are usually the ones that end up winning the conference or the division. In this case, the division. So I think that going into November with a good trajectory is important. And that means, you know, finishing October well, and not just winning games, but how are you playing? Are you healthy? Are you improving? Are you on a downslide on one side of the ball? So those things are important to me, because, you know, those teams that win in November ultimately are usually the ones that you don't see many teams winning, backing into a division win. It does happen every now and then. Last year was a little bit of an anomaly because of that Black Friday game, but it's, you know, that's, it's, I think it continues to be important. And again, it's one of those things that makes college football interesting.
And I'll take the last thing I want to say, Luke, is one thing I'll say for Derek. Is I know we're going to have a lot of extra listens on this podcast, rivalry game win. And I would say the number one question I get is, Ryan, I want to help NIL. How can I do it, but I don't have a lot of money? Well, if you're going to make a simple change that you're already doing in life, think about your alcohol purchases. If you're already going to drink a light beer, that's, say, Coors Light, Bud Light, go drink Duck Duck Beer, which is available at your liquor store by now. You're going to see it there. If you're already going to drink seltzers, say High Noon, whatever the seltzer brand might be, go grab a Grey Duck seltzer pack or a fan pack. If you're already going to drink vodka, and I'm a big vodka guy, my whole family is, and I know Kettle One, I know
Tito's, whatever, yeah.
Like, go drink Grey Duck vodka, which is available at your store. Because why? Because Dinkytown Athletes, the NIL collective that PJ Fleck talked about in the press conference yesterday, imploring people to drink some Duck Duck beer. They get, Derek, is it proceeds, revenue? How would you like to describe it?
Portion of net revenue at wholesale.
There you go. So if you're already going to drink a light beer, if you're already going to drink vodka, if you're already going to drink a seltzer pack, when you go into your liquor store next time to buy those things, light beer, find Duck Duck Beer. If it's a seltzer you're looking for, grab a Grey Duck fan pack. And if it's vodka you're looking for, go grab some Grey Duck vodka, because those are the simple changes that to you, it doesn't matter, because you are going to spend that money on the alcohol anyway. But that's a little small way of how you can help Minnesota's NIL collective.
I appreciate that, Ryan. I would just add too, we've had a lot of people that have jumped on, and that's awesome. If you're a fan, post about it on social media, let other Gopher fans, or talk about it. You know, there's a lot of people, a lot of Gopher fans that aren't on social media. So mention it to them, bring it up. If you like the product, mention it, because it does make a difference. This is something that, you know, most everybody can do, and it's fun. And it's kind of been cool to see that it's kind of bringing people together. It's kind of a rallying point for people, which is really cool. So help spread the word.
All right. We want to thank everybody again for listening. It's always fun to break down these games. It's especially fun when you break down a victory against a rival that you haven't beaten in a long time. Again, thank you for supporting our sponsors and also for just listening and making this possible. We have a ton of fun doing it. We look forward to previewing and breaking down the Michigan State game coming up soon. Again, thanks for listening and go.